Hello, welcome to the Quest. My name is Alan Mulhern. This is the second in our series on the archetypes. You may remember, if you listened to the first episode, that Richard Olivier, co-author of the book Archetypes at Work, explained the connections between archetypes and human character, and also as it applied to leadership in organisations. His co-author is Lawrence Hillman, and today we are delighted to speak to Lawrence about archetypal astrology, which underlies the book, you may or may not have noticed. So, Dr. Lawrence Hillman was raised in Zurich, Switzerland. He is a full-time astrologer, consultant, teacher, writer, and lecturer. He has been practicing astrology for 48 years. He has conducted workshops at Shakespeare's Globe in London and in Findhorn. He has taught at multiple universities and co-taught with his father, James Hillman. Lawrence is the co-author of Archetypes at Work. He is the author of several books and articles and holds degrees in architecture, business, engineering, and a PhD in psychology. He lives with his wife Cindy in St. Louis in the United States. Welcome, Lawrence, to the Quest series.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. I'm very pleased to be here.
I wish to begin by posing a question about the simplest of human experience in relationship to the stars. The universal, timeless feeling of awe and luminosity of the stars and planets in the nighttime sky. There is also the feeling that it is our home, that somehow we belong there. It's the mother that has created all. It's the infinite within which we have been placed in our particularity. I wonder if you can tell us more about this archetypal feeling and if you believe it is connected with the impulse to astrology.
I think it's a beautiful, beautiful image. And I think you're absolutely right. I think we feel awed and as though we're meeting something that is us, but also much larger than us. So it is one way to make that connection to what Jung called, you know, the collective unconscious. It's like this feeling there's something giant, massive out there. And yes, we're part of it. Of course, literally, we're all made of stardust. But on a soul level, we have lost the connection to feeling part of nature that was much more natural in past times, especially since the scientific era, where things had to be left-brainian, rational, and explainable to be real. And so this is, you know, the sky, the night sky offers us one of the ways to still feel connected, as do dreams, for instance. And this longing for a being part of something much, much larger than just our little lives. My friend once talked about a fly on a stage where a Shakespeare play is being performed. And the fly is trying to get a breadcrumb back to wherever flies live and is incredibly focused and obsessed with bringing this breadcrumb back to wherever it's going and trying to pick it up. And it's so big and, you know, all these kinds of the problems that the fly is having, as opposed to being aware of this extraordinary play that's going on above it. These voices, these costumes, these colors, these sounds, these songs, these sets, and completely missing the grandeur of it all. And often I think of us as flies like that, very obsessed with our breadcrumbs and not aware of the beauty of the spectacle around us. And the night sky offers us that connection.
Do you feel that could be connected or the basis of some deep impulse for astrology?
I think the curiosity of what's out there, I think, could be. You know, sort of the official story about how astrology started was with the worship of the sun, because it was very clear early on to humans that without the sun, we'd die. And so sun worshiping was sort of the first kind of astrology, if you want, looking up at begging, praying, desiring for the sun to come back every day so we could have light and warmth and food. On a deeper soul level, yes, I think it's the curiosity about infinity, what we experience as being so small in such a large universe, is a phenomenal, maybe uniquely human experience. I don't know what animals experience in the middle of the savannah when they look up at the night sky. I do know that humans have an awesome experience, and it's a lovely thing. You know, there's an old debate: was astrology invented or was it discovered? You know, did we discover the richness of the stories that are in the sky, or did we invent it and put them there? So that's an old debate. Of course, I believe it was discovered, but there's plenty of others who say no, it's all just invented. But that's a mindset. So that is it a left brain or a right brain approach? I think.
Thank you. Recently, I had reason to look at the book of Enoch in the Old Testament, where we find the story of the fallen angels sent down from paradise as watchers. Two of the fallen angels have the names of Cocobel, who taught humanity astrology and astronomy, and Sariel, who taught about the stars and the earth. So astrological knowledge would have been revealed by the fallen angels. Characterized by Carl Jung in his Answer to Job as the split-off dark side of the Godhead. Nevertheless, it appears to me that astrology seeped even into the Jewish and Christian religions, though they were officially opposed to it. I wonder if the names and specialisms of these fallen angels had come to your attention.
Not at first, but I wrote it down and I'm going to go look at it. I'm curious. That I know that astrology shows up all over the place in the Bible. I know it shows up all over the place in Shakespeare. It shows up in all major idea places. It shows up in every church if you know where to look, the symbolism, at least in Catholic churches. There is a fascinating love-hate relationship that people have had. The astrologers were, you know, all invited in and asked to help, you know, in Spain, for instance, for many centuries. And then suddenly they became too powerful and then the popes kicked them all out. So, you know, we have this love-hate relationship with this art form.
Now, returning to this mindset you mentioned earlier, Lawrence, there are many people who are skeptical of astrology and others who are fascinated and intrigued. I must admit I have oscillated between the two, adopting largely a skeptical position, but every 5 or 10 years or so dipping into that fascinating sea, swimming out some distance, and then coming back to shore. What would you say to this voice of skepticism?
I used to spend a lot of time trying to convince skeptics and make arguments and go back and forth and these kinds of things. I don't do that anymore. To me, it's a choice and it's a tool. And, you know, if someone says, I don't believe in a screwdriver, then they're not believing in the tool. But I would be curious, have you ever needed a screwdriver? Have you ever wanted to use a screwdriver? And was it the best tool for the job? It depends what you're trying to do. So it's a real thing and it's a tool. It's not magic. It can be taught. Anybody can learn it. And it is something that many people judge without having an experience of it. The famous line is from Newton, who studied astrology and his colleagues were skeptical. And he basically said the famous line, you know, sir, I have studied it and you have not. Basically, learn about it. I have no problems with someone being a skeptic if they have studied it. But I know of actual physicists who have studied astrology, who became devotees of it once they tried it out. So if you deny something because it can't be so, then I'm more interested in your mindset. So what are you afraid of? That you're not in control, that somehow the heavens are in control of your life? These kinds of things, that you're being influenced and you don't have free will. What is the psychology behind your skepticism is something I'm curious about. So I think life is too short. There are a lot of people who are getting it, and I encourage people who are curious to take a leap of faith and talk to someone. Yes, and it is faith, because you have to believe that there is a connection between the heavens and you. But it's that connection that is the re-mystifying of nature that is what we talked about just now. And so if you have a leap of faith that that's true, if you believe that maybe you can talk to a tree, then there is this reopening of an animation, a filling with anima of the world. And that is a richness that is unparalleled, that is certainly much bigger than just astrology itself. That opens you up to possibilities that are delightful. My father used to talk a lot about, what tree are you sitting in? And just to be aware of the tree that we're sitting in when we don't believe in astrology, that means that we prefer things that we can measure, that we prefer things that are rational, that we prefer things that are real, quote unquote. That with that statement, we're also saying that those things that we can't measure are not real. And that is a mindset that is no longer enough in the modern world, I think. People are recognizing that, so they are starting to long for and go back to things like plant medicine, everywhere, and trying ways to access this non-measurable world.
I noticed that in the book on archetypes at work that there is an astrological planetary influences behind the 10 archetypes that are put forward. Very interesting chapter at the back, connecting it to the planets. And I wonder if you can explain to us the connection between astrology and the archetypes.
Yes, I'm an archetypal astrologer, which means that the planets to me are archetypal patterns, if you want. Archetypal figures is probably the best word for it. And so to me, when I look up at the night sky, the planets are performing a play. There's a story going on. And because I know what I know, I can tell if that play is a comedy or a tragedy. It's a way of measuring the kind of time that we're born into or that is going on at this moment. If I want to know the kind of time I was born into, following the idea that the acorn contains the oak tree, then I would want to know the story of the heavens at that time. So these characters, these planets, these actors, to me, are archetypal, which means they are universal. They're understood by anybody in any culture. It doesn't matter how old you are, how you look, or gender you have, or these kinds of things are irrelevant. These are deeper human experiences that have been around forever. So there's endless archetypes. Jung had certain ones that he was interested in. There are endless patterns like that. We don't know how many they are. You can't count them up and rationally put them in boxes. But what we know is that over time and in the heavens, again, looking at the sky is archetypal, there are 10. There are 10 planets that we can recognize, that we have studied, that we have, massive amounts of data on for those left-brainers who want that. The movements of the planets is the oldest science that there is. 5,000 years ago, the Babylonians were already tracking the movements of the heavens and correlating that to events on Earth, to sort of in an empirical fashion. And so the patterns of the sky, the patterns of time can be measured, if you want, by looking at the correlation between these 10, sort of what play are they performing together? Is this a happy time or a difficult time or a stressful time? And that kind of an idea. Just like a play has a quality, astrology essentially is a clock that measures the quality of a moment. So these 10 have been around for a long time. So when we wrote Archetypes at Work, we basically took those 10, but also understood that to make it more palatable to more people, we wanted to talk about archetypes and not about planets because that's confusing to people and it gets into woo-woo for people and it gets so we didn't hide that, but we also didn't put it on the front of the book so that more people would pick it up and look at it and give it a shot and then see if it was for them or not. So there's a direct correlation between the 10 archetypes that we use in our model and the 10 planets, because that's where the idea comes from that we have a set here that is complete and that can actually read this complexity of massive amounts of archetypes and give us everything that we need to do any analysis of any situation or person or behavior or things like that. So another analogy would be music. There's endless tones that we can hear, endless. But we have a system of 12 in the West anyway. On the piano, that's five black keys and seven white keys that play an octave. And with those 12 notes, you can play any music, any song in any style. And that's enough. Even though there's endless frequencies between them, we don't need those other ones because we have a set that can play what we need to play. So astrology is very similar. These 10 archetypes are a full set. I've been working with archetypes for 48 years, and there's not a behavior, a situation, a crisis, anything you name it, that can't be explained with either one or a combination of them. It's understood. It's just like you can play that melody with these archetypes. So we've made a connection between what is better understood in the business world than planetary words and names, but the ideas, the concepts, the archetypal nature of them is the same. So to make the actual connection, you know, when we talk about the sun, we talk about the sovereign, which is something that everybody understands. There's a sovereign quality to the sun. There's also the moon, which is the nurturing part of us, the receptive. Then there is Mercury, which is the storyteller. Then there is Venus, which is the lover. Then there is Mars, which is the warrior. Then there is Jupiter, who is the explorer. Then there is Saturn, who is the strategist, structures and organizes things. Then there is Uranus, who is the renegade. And then there is Neptune, the dreamer. And finally, Pluto, the transformer. So that's the correlation that we made. But essentially, the challenge that we had, my partner Richard Olivier and I, is that we basically had to take the English dictionary and run it through a funnel. And what came out of the bottom was 10 words, which is extraordinarily difficult. And it's never perfect and it's never exact, but it is good enough, which is why we then added, you know, 20 or 30 key words for each of them to better describe what we mean when we say explorer, for instance, to flesh it out if you want. But in essence, we have with those 10 words and what they mean to us in our model, you can describe any situation in business or in a person's life.
Intriguing. So, if we took Explorer as an archetype in someone's character, would it be possible to describe it sometimes as too much and other times too little, for example?
Yes, any archetype appears on a scale from too much on one side and too little on the other side. And then it's what we call the optimal zone in the middle, where you're expressing that archetype as a gift to you and to the world. So, for instance, too much explorer is, you know, exaggeration, is, you know, overly enthusiastic, bombastic, loud, coming in strong, you know, everything is great, everything's fantastic. A lot of Europeans see Americans as having too much jovial energy, too much of that, you know, how are you? I'm great, you know, I'm always great, you know, that kind of stuff. That's American. Some cultures have it in general, but there is an optimism that goes with that as well, and a joy that goes with that as well, and even some humor at times. But you can overplay that. So you can overplay your inner Jupiter. And again, the key thing you just mentioned here, Alan, is that key idea about an archetypal mindset is that we are multiple inside. This is inner complexity, that all of these archetypes are there all the time. You don't have a single identity. And again, we have Jung to thank for that way of thinking, amongst others, but that inner richness, you are not a single I that is developing the way developmental psychologists think about it. It's much richer than that. So this multiplicity for Jupiter, for the jovial side, is too much. If you have too little Jupiter, then you're basically joyless. You know, if you're not expressing your Jupiter well, shadow of too little, we call that. Then you are, things aren't funny to you. Things aren't, you know, there's no reason to learn anything new. I know what I know. You know, I'm kind of stuck in my ways. I never travel anywhere. I'm not curious in other ways of thinking. That's too little Jupiter. And so you can very quickly recognize human behavior and then sometimes catch yourself on a bad day doing exactly those things, both the too much and too little. The classic example is the warrior. We often use that, especially in business. That someone who's in their warrior as a gift is clear, is sharp, is focused on the target they want to reach in life, can defend other people, can defend themselves, can stand up for what they believe, these kinds of things. But too much warrior is a bully who screams at people, and too little warrior is someone who can't defend themselves and who gets walked over in meetings all the time. So where is your warrior in these examples is what we ask. And where we go in, and that's where the work starts. Because then, if you say, well, it's costing me a lot because my warrior is low, how do we activate that warrior and make it more useful to you? That's the model.
So just as the 10 archetypes are potentially available to any person or organization, so by parallel, the 10 planets are around us all the time.
And in us all the time.
So they are around us and in us at our birth. Now, with respect to the natal chart, do you believe, and is it your experience, that at birth, a unique character and destiny is constellated?
Yes, we're born. This is the idea of the acorn. Pythagoras said it a little differently. He said that at the moment of birth, we are sort of impressed by the heavens like soft wax, which I thought was just a beautiful image. And there is this notion that, well, the acorn is the best analogy. My father's book, The Soul's Code, certainly speaks to that. Is that in that moment that you are born into, it is the beginning, and everything that unfolds from there is contained in its seed, in its origin, in its beginning. That's a very old idea, and nature does that all the time. We do that too. We start out as once, as you know, two cells. And so in that contains the extraordinary, if you want, the DNA of the rest of us. So you could think of the chart as the DNA of your soul, if you want, which is a term that I have used, the archetypes, as the idea of the being the DNA of the soul. It is the core structures that are there into which we then weave development and our family and our culture and all these things that speak to it as well. But there is this core, deepest underlying imprint that is there that then unfolds according to all of these other things. So if we talk about the oak tree, you know, when the tree is 3 feet tall and a deer comes by and eats off a branch, I have no idea if deers like oak, but let's pretend they do, then, you know, that branch isn't going to grow. But also nature teaches us that another branch is going to grow more when one branch is sacrificed, if you want. So these kinds of ideas have a lot to do then how we think about human growth and development and individuation in Jungian terms. We start out with a blueprint. And, you know, I'm a trained architect. And so, you know, the blueprint usually doesn't get built as designed. Usually there's change orders along the way. So that's influence, that's development. But the blueprint is there and it's a potential. And when we get off track in life and we feel lost and we feel, you know, we're usually very misaligned from the blueprint. And that's when astrology can help to get us realigned with who we really are. The greatest feedback that I've gotten talking to thousands of people over many decades, the line that makes me the, if you want, the happiest, because I know that's what we're here to do, is when someone says, "I really feel seen." I'm reminded of Ginsberg, who said, you know, "Be who we really are, everybody's taken, everyone else." So to really feel seen in our deepest nature without any judgment or criticism, without any shoulds or shouldn'ts, but to this is who I am. Now we can ask a second question. Well, with this who I am, how do I fit in or not fit into my environment? And what does that mean for me? And now we have a plan we can start to put in place about how we deal with that. But you can't be someone else. You can't be who you weren't meant to be, what's not in your nature. And that nature can be read really, really, really well on the deepest level that I know in an astrological reading.
I'm reminded of your father's, James Hillman's, book, The Soul's Code, that you just mentioned, in which he presents the daemon, that unique character stamp at birth, one's destiny, one's soul's code. I can see how that's connected to the world of astrology. I was also reminded, as a Jungian psychotherapist, that many therapists focus on what has gone wrong in one's upbringing, perhaps over-focus. But from the astrological point of view, which you've just described, and the point of view of this daemon, this original character, the image of the acorn, the blueprint, our developmental destiny, the telos that's within us, the work that is to unfold. That may be deflected, it may be damaged, it may be influenced in all kinds of ways. But surely it is the task, from this point of view, to align oneself with one's original blueprint, one's true self.
Yes, beautifully said. And one of my big pet peeves, I'm with you. I think there's three ways that we can go through life just on a philosophical level. The first way is to say life happens to me, which is a victim mentality and quite popular in the circles you just mentioned. You know, well, they did this to me and they did that to me. If I'd only had this or that, had that, things would have been better. That's a victim idea, but that's very common. Another way to go through life is to say, I make life happen. It's all up to me, and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get things together and be in charge of your own life, and no one's going to do anything for you. That's a very American fantasy. Go west, young man, take your gun, take what's yours, those kinds of things. Manifest destiny, these ideas, very American. That's an ego approach to life. It's all about me. And then there's a third way, which I try very much to adhere to, even though I'm not always successful, which says life is already happening. My job is to co-create with what's already going on around me. So that means a couple of things. That means I have to know what's going on around me on an archetypal level, which is what I use astrology for. And then by knowing transits and knowing what's going on in real time and knowing what play I'm in, and then co-creating with that play. If I'm in a tragedy, I'm not going to run around and tell jokes. If I'm in a comedy, I might go to my joke file. So it's about being sensitive to the world that is already not thinking that I'm at the center of it, but recognizing how I am a grain of sand on a beach, and then being really fully aware that I am really important in this context, that I need to know who I am and what my contributions can be in the context of the whole. I'm not separate from the whole, but I'm also separate from the whole.
The natal chart, as I now understand it, is a moment at the time of one's birth, so it's a particular time, date, and location. Can you explain how the natal chart is constructed and how the planets are aligned for any individual?
Yes, of course. So essentially, we're born under a sky. That's the idea. And that the as above, so below matters. That's the connection between me and the heavens. So what an astrologer does is she draws up the sky that was above the place of your birth when you took your first breath. That's the idea. And that sky varies. If you're in the north half of the above the equator or below the equator, these kinds of things matter. Where you're born matters, the place, and also the minute, because the sky is constantly moving. Of course, we're the ones moving. The skies are fixed stars. We're the ones rotating on the earth. So we're moving in time, around the sun, but also rotating in a 24-hour cycle. And so astrologers basically fix the moment that you're born, take a snapshot of the sky, and then draw up a picture of that, if you want, a drawing of that, which is a unique imprint, a moment. It is a lot like a snowflake. It is unique. No one has the same chart. Yes, twins are born minutes apart, but even that, those minutes make a difference, and that's a whole other conversation. And yes, it's also that two babies may be born in the same minute in the same hospital in two different rooms, to two different families, and that's again where the nurture is going to play a big part as well. They go home to different families, different ideas, different philosophies. They get raised differently, but they will have remarkably similar behaviors and do similar things. Studies have been done on twins and things like that. And again, on an archetypal nature, what it also says, that story of the two babies born at the same time in the same place, is that there are endless forms of expression of the same archetypal pattern. If Saturn and the moon were aligned when you were born, they were both sort of in the same place in the sky at that moment. It's called a Saturn-moon conjunction. So you can type in Saturn-moon conjunction into Google and probably get 10,000 different opinions of what that means, right? So then you can say, well, that's just fake. If I drop, the speed of gravity is determined, that's a fixed constant, so that's real. But if 10,000 people give me 10,000 different answers, it can't be real. That's not true, because because we have to be more subtle. We have to use an interpretive capability, a right brain way to approach the story of what that Saturn moon means for that person. In one person, it means a lot of depression. In another person, it means an older mother. In another person, it means, limited housing. In another person, it means building houses for the poor. It can mean all kinds of different things. But an archetypal eye discovers that in those four little stories I just gave you, we are always looking at a Saturn moon story. So the creative process here is grand, and to find out what the best way for you to express your Saturn moon conjunction that isn't about depression, but rather about building houses for the poor, that's what the developmental work is in astrology. That's what the work is of the astrologers, to show those possibilities and to say, well, you could also do this in a different way. It is incredibly relieving for people when they see that they can do the thing they've been doing in a certain way all their lives in a different way. That to me is the healing power of astrology, is that as long as you stay within the archetypal pattern, you can't escape the moon Saturn thing and say, well, I'm just not going to do that because that's just not going to be me because I don't like it. Instead, you could say, what for me? It's sort of like, playing the cards you were dealt. What's the best hand I can play with these cards? There are a lot of fabulous things people have done with Saturn moon conjunctions, and there are a lot of difficult things people have done, and that's true for any archetypal pattern.
Thank you. Can you explain the difference between oppositions, conjunctions, and sextiles?
Absolutely. So there are what we call major aspects. Aspects comes from the Latin word aspectare, which means to see. So it's how the planets see each other. The way we make the heavens sort of, graspable or manageable from down here is we draw the planets on a circle. So those of you who have seen your astrological chart have seen a circle. And then the planets are positioned in degrees around that circle where they are in the sky above you. So that's a way of putting it down on paper, if you want. It's a format. So when you have two points on a circle, you can measure the angle between them. You draw a line from each point to the middle of the circle, and now you have an angle. So if that angle is 0 degrees, if they're right next to each other, then that's called a conjunction. If they're 180 degrees apart, right across from each other on the circle, then that's called an opposition. If they're 120 degrees apart, that's called a trine. 60 degrees is a sextile you mentioned. And then there's also 90 degrees, which is a square. And finally, there's the quincunx, which is 150 degrees. And those are the aspects that I use. There's other ways you could have other angles that you're interested in. I don't use those, but others do. Doesn't mean one is right and one is wrong. There are different ways and different perceptions.
So, for example, if we look at my chart, which you did for me a few days ago, you pointed out to me that in the ascendant are the Moon and Jupiter, very close, and opposite to them, Pluto is descending below the horizon. So Pluto is in opposition to Moon and Jupiter. What can someone of this archetypal configuration expect? Not only in their life, but in themselves.
Whatever Pluto touches needs deepening and is demanded to be deepened. Pluto is the most powerful and the most relentless part of us that demands whatever it relates to on our stage to be connected with. Imagine a character with a hat halfway down her face sitting on a bench in the corner of the stage, and there's some intensity from that character all the time as the rest of the actors are doing their thing on your stage. This on your inner stage, this character demands attention, and there's something eerie, something important, something demanding coming from that, like a tango dancer who just sat down. This is someone I'm going to have to wrestle with in life. We all do in some ways, but for some people, this is a particularly important actor. Again, we can talk about lead actors or key figures or things like that. And so, if that's a key figure for you, in this case, there is a tension between Jupiter and the Moon, and on the one side of the stage, and there is this figure of Pluto on the other side of the Moon, and there is a time in your life, most likely always, but also sometimes these things take time to unfold, where the Jupiter moon are required to face whatever Pluto is demanding of them. And so that will be an internal process. It will be a deepening. It will be a reckoning. It will be a stripping of false ideas about Jupiter and moon that we may have had and things like that. So it's a stripping down of realities that we didn't want to have. Sometimes that takes a trauma to activate. Sometimes that takes Jungian thought, particularly values suffering in that sense that it awakens us and it takes us deeper. And it's not a bad thing. It's not a comfortable thing, but growth has never been comfortable. But it is these silver linings that we get out of trauma. And so Pluto reminds us of that. It's the healing power that comes from stripping away the unnecessary and getting to the core of things and going deeper.
That's extremely interesting for me. So I'm very interested in how Pluto deepens the nurturer and the wanderer and the explorer in me, demanding change and transformation. Lawrence, could you explain to us the difference between a natal chart, a personal transit, and a world transit?
Absolutely. And thank you for your excellent questions, by the way. So the natal chart is the chart, the moment that you were born, which literally is what we usually call a horoscope, which comes from the Greek two words, horos and skopos, which means hour. Horos is hour and skopos is pictures. It's picture of the hour. And that is your natal chart, usually called a horoscope. That word has sort of been hijacked by horoscopes in the back of magazines, which are sun sign astrology and are, little blurbs that tell you something about your sign, which is not astrology the way I practice it. And, speaks about one of the 10 actors on the stage and ignores the other nine. That's like describing you by your shoe size. It's not a very good, doesn't do a very good job. Or some other stereotype, like, all Italians are good lovers or whatever, French like food. These kinds of statements are generic for a whole population, not astrology, the way I think of it. Horoscope is what that's what that really means. The other term for it that is used a lot is a natal chart. That's a moment in time that's frozen. In real time, of course, the planets keep moving. And so the movements of this, the live sky, or at any time in your life, if you want to go back to when you were 10 years old and something happened, you can look at where the planets were in real time when you were 10, and then overlay that over your natal chart. And then you can see what parts of you were activated, or in the theater metaphor, what was in the spotlight, what was suddenly center stage that might not be so much. So suddenly that figure in the corner on the chair that we were talking about, that Pluto figure, suddenly the spotlight is cast upon her and something dramatic happens in your life. That's how you explain events in your life that are life-changing, is when these transits, these outer planets, activate certain parts of yourself. It's a really powerful tool to understand when we go through things that are incomprehensible for their fright, for their horror, for their tragedy, and things like that. So, to paraphrase Nietzsche, we can take any what if we know why. And so, astrology gives you a why, and that's really helpful. And the other, you can understand why, okay, that makes sense that my great grandfather died and he was so important to me as a little child. And it happened, because this was the initiation. You can understand the deeper story. And we can then take it better. The other thing about transits, which is what we're talking about, which just literally means moving over or activating parts of your chart, is the transits have an expiration date, as I like to say. And so if you're in the middle of a crisis, you know when this planet moves on, that things get easier. That is incredibly helpful when someone is in a really bad place. And I can't tell you how many thank you notes I've gotten from people. Thank God I knew that March would be better, because now, a skeptic is going to say, well, you programmed them. And so March came along and now they felt better because you told them they'd feel better. It's not that simple. The psyche isn't that simply manipulated. And if someone wants to believe that, that's fine. I know what I care about is the reaction of the clients. And if it helps them, then, and I've seen it in my own life countless times that the release of a transit, the moving along of a planet can be hugely relieving. And also, there can be a loss. There can be a sense of, Mercury was really active in my chart for a while and I was writing like crazy. And suddenly that activation is gone. And suddenly I have a writer's block and nothing's coming to me. So it's not about good or bad. It's just what is right now, what's center stage? And so to take advantage of the way the winds are blowing and to set your sails accordingly can be really nice. And astrology does that. And the last one you asked about is that, of course, the planets in real time are also telling the story of the backdrop of all of us. And that's called world transits, if you want, or mundane, as it's called, as in world, mundane astrology. And so, yes, you can understand and explain everything that's going on today. And those people who are lost and are freaking out about all the changes in the world would do well, in my mind, especially if they're scared, to find some answers, because astrology can very easily explain literally easily. It's not a short answer, but it's easily explained. Everything, literally everything that's going on in the world, politically, environmentally, it's explainable. And again, we can take any what if we know why, and that's not going to get us out of trouble. But the explanation makes sense so that we can start to ask, well, what does it mean to become future fit? What does it mean as a human being on a soul level to become ready for this new age that's clearly approaching very rapidly and that is scary for many, many people today? So astrology can help with complicated, not simple, placating answers, but with complicated demands on us. But we can understand what it means and what we need to activate in ourselves to co-create with this future that's appearing.
Fascinating. Thank you, Lawrence. Can you now tell us what is the implications and significance of the world passing from the age of Pisces to that of Aquarius?
Absolutely. So each era, the way we talk about the age of Aquarius, which is, we're in the process of entering. It's not a light switch that you flip and now you're in one age and then you were in the other age. This is a process of hundreds of years. There have been glimpses of the age of Aquarius for a while, and there are clearly signs of what is happening in the world that are very Aquarian, and they include, I'll give you some key words that are to belong squarely into Aquarius and not into Pisces. Everything global is an Aquarian idea. Universality is exploration of the universe, other life forms, inventions, technology, networks, studying the neural networks of the brain in a way that we never have before, studying the networks of people, not just social networks, but all the ways that we are connected now. For the first time, bees are not very smart individually, but they're damn smart as a collective. And this collective intelligence of the human mind has never been able to be fully set into motion, but it is now, and AI is definitely doing that in a way that is extraordinary. I'm very interested in AI, and I'm not naive to it and the dangers of it and all of that. But we are evolving in a way that is creating this universal mind that we can all tap into. And sure, there's a lot of nefarious fantasies and a lot of fears all over the place. And I get all of that, but we're always afraid of the new because we don't understand it. And we have no capacity yet to really comprehend what we have unleashed. It's a classic golem moment. Have we invented this or have we found it? It's very similar to astrology. So has it appeared and we have grasped it, or have we made it? It's a human creation. This is again a whole other conversation about what is creativity. But so the age of Aquarius that we're entering is about a different dyad. Each era appears as a dyad, the key dyad for the next 2,000 years. That's how long these ages last, approximately. The next 2,000 years, the main dyad is between what we could call me as an individual and my own creativity and who I am when I look in the mirror, and me as being part of the collective, or what I used before the term of a grain of sand on a beach. This struggle, when you really dig down into that struggle on the human philosophical level, is the struggle of our times. And there's so much fear about losing my identity in the collective and my identity being stolen, these kinds of things, as opposed to, what makes me a human and when am I just part of a cog in the wheel to the AI that's running my life. That conversation, we're in the first couple of years of that conversation because AI is brand new. But this is the question that we will answer over the next 2,000 years. And yes, I think we will be around for a while. I don't think we're going anywhere as a human species. I don't believe in self-destruction in that way. This is a different conversation. The one from the last 2,000 years, you asked me about what's the difference, was a different dyad. That dyad was one between what we could simply put as the conversation between science and religion, between belief and what's measurable, or split between left brain and right brain. And so that still being duked out, that's not complete yet. They're still teaching creationism in parts of the United States. So that is a conversation that is not easily ended. And I don't think that when an era ends or an age ends, that everything we've learned there is going to go away. It gets integrated into the new with the new knowledge that we have. So being on this threshold between belief and science and me and the collective is a massive shift for everybody. And there are lots of people who want to go back to the past. That to me explains Trump and Brexit and all of it. I want to go back to something that they understand, and they don't understand this new world, and it's freaking them out. And yet, what we learn from astrology is that we all have the tools in us to connect to this because we all have an inner Aquarius. And so, activating that means becoming future fit. That sounds really simple, but that takes some work.
So, do you feel that the human future is a transhuman one?
Transhuman future? I don't know. That's a big question. I think we're being transformed. Yes, I think the person of today is a very different person from a person 100 years ago, a drastically different person on so many different levels, some for the better, some for the worse, if we want to judge it. But this new world is here, and we have a choice. You know, imagine if you're, having your afternoon tea, and there's a knock on the door, and you go and open the door, and there's two aliens standing there. What are you going to do? This is how a lot of people feel today. Are you going to grab your shotgun, as many in America might do, and try to shoot them? Are you going to run away and hide? Or are you going to invite them in for some tea and ask them some questions? That's a choice. The fact that the aliens are standing there is true. And for a lot of different people, that is really frightening because they don't know what this is. This is a life form. This is a shift in human consciousness. And that's happening on so many different levels, and it's freaking people out. It's similar to, the Copernican Revolution, where the idea that we are not at the center of the universe, that the church was very, famously guarding and saying, no, God made us and we're at the center of it all. When that was sort of thwarted by the idea, no, actually, we're going around the sun. We're just one of many planets that are flying around the sun at incredible speeds. We're not that important. Rick Tarnas writes beautifully about the Copernican Revolution, the importance in the shifting of human consciousness in general. We're going through a similar time, and we don't quite know yet what this new revolution is about, but it is a transformation of human consciousness. And as with all change, that comes in with violence, comes in radically, comes in scarily, and is not something that people just happily embrace and go on with their day. It's just not how things go. We're creatures of habit.
Thank you. Now, you're the co-author with Richard Olivier of the book Archetypes at Work, which he introduced to us in the last episode. And I'm wondering, from your point of view as an archetypal astrologer, how you find the introduction of such ideas as archetypes are received in the corporate world.
I have this sort of rule of thumb about curiosity and where we are as a collective, especially around the archetypes at work. As you can imagine, that's not for everybody in a corporate setting. But there's such a hunger for soul in corporations. It is extraordinary to me. And this is a way of bringing soul back into the workplace. And it works. And it is extraordinary. We're working with a Fortune 500 company now with 150,000 employees globally. And the hunger that is there is remarkable to me. This is real, and we need a way to be able to speak corporate speak without just writing more stupid things as we see in briefs and so forth, but instead writing it or speaking corporate speak in a soulful way, which is what we've attempted to do and are actually succeeding remarkably, I find. But I think of it this way: if I go to a party and there's 10 people there, eight of them want nothing to do with what I have to say, or have want nothing to do with, what do you mean soul in business? It's about profit. What are you talking about? This kind of a thing. And many of those maybe represent companies that are too big to fail or too much, ingrained in the system, whatever. So I don't really have enough time in my life. I'm 64 to spend time trying to convince them of anything. One of the 10 in the group already gets it. They're already doing what needs to be done for them to be connected to this new age and to the new world, and they understand. And then one of them is curious. They know that what has brought them to where they are isn't going to get them to where they need to go. They don't know what to do, and they're open to some weird stuff, even this weird stuff that we're bringing. And that's the person I'm looking for and interested in. That's 10%. In my lifetime, I will never have enough time to, speak to 10% of people who are curious about this. And so we have, done other things like create a guild of practitioners, people who are trained in this model, who are going out and working it in the world on their own, and found ways to spread that kind of thinking and this tool to others. But I'm interested in the 10% who are curious. I'm not interested in the other, because I'm not in the business of convincing people or arguing with people. It's a big waste of time. Either somebody gives it a try, back to Newton, I've tried it, you have not, try it out, then let's have a conversation. But I've never met anybody who, after they tried it out, argues against it.
Yes, I see. Lawrence, I wonder if you can finally let listeners know where you can be contacted and what kind of offerings you have.
Thank you for that opportunity. Basically, lawrencehillman.com is the place to start. That's where people sign up for readings. That's where people can read about my work, what I do, who I work with, and how, and so forth. I do astrological readings, and I also do coaching with leaders, leadership coaching, and work with people, in many different ways. And then there's a link there to Archetypes at Work, which explains more. About the or archetypesatwork.com is the direct link to that work, which talks more about the model and what it can do. There's even a free assessment that you can take on the Archetypes at Work website, answer 50 questions and get sort of a printout, a very simple printout of your own archetypal pattern, at least the top and the bottom one, the one you're most comfortable with, the one you're least comfortable with, to start to think in these ways and to get some. It's a taster. It's not the real thing, but it's a good way to get it to start the conversation for those who are interested but really don't know how to approach it. And there's ways to dip your toes into this work without, having to call yourself a believer or, give up everything you've believed so far and things like that. I believe in having embodied experiences. That's what matters. That's how adults learn. What Meserov called, a disorienting dilemma. You have to have an experience that you can't explain, and a chart can be a really good model for strong left-brainers to have an experience that they can't explain. How the hell could this guy know all of this about me? That's fine. That's a good start of the conversation, because that will lead to curiosity. Now I want to know how this works, because that kind of blows my mind or freaks me out. And even scares me at times. And it's not scary, it's learnable. I'm also teaching a course for the first time to introduce, the ability for people to learn how to decipher a chart if they've never, if they want to know how to do that. It's a 9-week course. It's now an evergreen course. People can buy that as an online video course of 9 weeks and also get access to the question and answers that people asked in the live course, or they can take it live again. And that is at Cosmos Institute with a K .org. And that's a great school that I've aligned myself with now to do some teaching. But I do a lot of teaching. So, there's different things that I'm doing, teaching all the time. Go to my website.
Lawrence Hillman, thank you for an intriguing and deeply thought-provoking presentation of archetypal astrology.
Thank you so much, Alan.